that makes me know that we had the right idea in the beginning, and we just need to maintain our focus and elevate. We update our formulas. We have certain formulas, but we update them with the times and everything, you know? And so.
Hello, all you sexy basketball people, and welcome to the Teardrop Runners, the show where four old friends get together and try to teach themselves and each other a little something about basketball analytics. We're not experts, we're not basketball writers, we're just four dumb goons who love the NBA and even occasionally watch it. We are, however, required by law to spend the first 20 minutes of any basketball podcast talking about a topic that no one's talking about: what's wrong with the Lakers. Rob, what's wrong with the Lakers?
Absolutely.
Just kidding, no one cares. We will start this week with some scouting that we've been doing over the course of this week. Each one of us this week has been watching, reading up on, and crunching the numbers on various players. At Manziel, you took the number one overall pick in this year's draft, Anthony Davis of the New Orleans Hornets. What do you have to tell us about him?
Yeah, I scouted Anthony Davis here all the way from Brooklyn using my telescope. I watched obviously the Portland game that he played and a little bit of the Minnesota game that he played. My general impression was that he stands around a lot and doesn't put himself really into the game, in his last couple of games. So I read up that, you know, maybe his ankle's still bothering him, but he seemed a lot like a non-factor to me. And the other thing that I saw just in terms of watching him play is that the team puts him in a lot of situations that you don't typically put a rookie big man in, which is with the ball in his hand, facing up on the basket, trying to dribble drive, things like that. And, I think he's a guy with a lot of gifts, but it seems like a tough way to get into the league.
Don't you think number one overall pick should get that kind of, you know, when it's a team that's clearly not going to be making a playoff run? Don't you think that's a team, you know, that's something that they're going to give their big man? They clearly need time to learn, but let's just, you know, just throw him all the way in and see what happens? Or you think they're putting too much on him?
Maybe, but there's not a lot of big men in the whole league that do that anyhow, and I don't think that's going to be his biggest impact on the game. So it's developing a part of a game that I think maybe is a little bit superfluous, because he can score by collecting a ton of offensive boards. He can score on a pick and roll and a quick dunk. What I just don't want to see him dribbling near the elbow to try to get closer to the basket. That just seems like the worst way that he can score throughout his career.
Yeah.
So it sounds like bad coaching.
Let's not disparage Monty Williams in this house.
I knew you were going to defend that, Scott.
I do wonder what the plan is there.
I think the plan is to hope that Eric Gordon either decides that his knee is good enough to play basketball or goes away.
I'm putting my money on go away.
Yeah, that's probably right.
So a couple quick questions, Manny. What's his problem being physically this season? Is it an ankle injury, or is it that hedge injury, or how come he hasn't played a whole lot?
So he did get a concussion early in the season. That took him out for a few games. But the real injury is this ankle injury. And,
okay.
You know, I don't see him out there limping, so what can I say about how it affects him? I can't really tell.
Do you think they're trying to be conservative, I guess, bringing him back?
They're being somewhat conservative with his minutes. He's right about 25 to 30 a game. He didn't start, for example, against Portland. Or since he's been back, really. And so in that way, they've been conservative, but, you know, his game is going to be jumping up in the air and blocking shots, intimidating shots, or, you know, letting the ball up off the glass. So I don't know how
okay.
he can really be with his ankle.
Right.
Okay.
Well, and he does have a particularly good handle for a guy of his body type, right?
Well, he has a really good touch. Yeah. Especially for being gangly, you'd think he wouldn't be able to dribble the ball 2 feet, but. Yeah,
right.
He did get to the rim at least once. I saw from somewhere outside the key, but I also saw twice where, you know, the ball got poked away, bounced off a foot, was turned over. So,
is he blocking shots like he did in college?
Since he came back, he's not blocking shots at a great rate now. So he is at I want to say 2.5 blocks per 36 minutes, which is significantly below guys like JaVale McGee, or it's even lower than Andre Drummond, who's at 2.8.
Okay. That's still a lot, though. I mean, it's not a lot, but it's still good. It's no Serge Ibaka.
Another thing I'm seeing on 82games.com is that his production for his position is good. So he's actually kind of outproducing his opponent by 11 points a game, but his plus minus is bad. This makes me, you know, I haven't seen him play yet, but kind of makes me think that he's scoring the ball a lot, but maybe not efficiently, or he's scoring a lot and giving up even more on the defensive end. Do you know?
Well, he's scoring.
What are you seeing scouting?
But this could, plus minus being bad could just go to the fact that they're 5-18 as a team. You know what I mean?
They're a bad team.
Yeah, they're not good at that.
True. I mean, it's unadjusted plus minus, and yet, you know, some guys on that team do have positive numbers. So, I mean, you know, he's not doing well on the team, even compared to his teammates.
He's also played a majority of his games now kind of in between the starting unit and the bench unit.
Okay.
So he's probably going to be more sensitive to most than being in some weird combinations.
Okay.
But did you guys have a chance? I posted a link to Vorp, his shot chart.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a great site. You know, I had not seen that site before. For those that don't know, it's Vorped as in value over replacement player, but in the past tense, Vorped.com, and they have some really great shot charts for every player.
Every single player in the league, you can break it out by game. There's a few other. They have the database of what referees are refereeing which game.
Yeah.
There's a lot of good stuff there.
Yeah, it's an excellent site. I'm glad you brought it to my attention. I'd never heard of it before you sent that link.
Yeah, I found it randomly myself. So just to wrap it up a little bit on Anthony Davis, basically I think unless he's playing hard, then, you know, he doesn't look super special to me. So hopefully he'll get back from an ankle injury and look like the type of guy who's ready to be a star in the NBA, you know, from game one.
Right. I also think, I guess I sort of think it's a little hard for centers to come out and dominate games from day one, you know, because they have so little control over both the offense and the defense. And there is a lot of learning and watching that has to take place for a player like Davis. So,
yeah, I didn't think he'd come in and be a top level shot blocker and rebounder right away, which we're not really seeing.
Right. He does look a little tentative, I think, right?
Yeah, I mean, he kind of mentally
wonders. Do you like his game in comparison to his game in the Olympics when he was playing with NBA players? Obviously, he was in a much better situation there. But do you think, like, he would fit better on a team where he's not, you know, basically the only or one of two offensive scoring options? Do you think that's what's hurting?
I gotta throw that one to the Walnut, who I know watched Olympics like a hawk.
Well, you know, his Olympic scoring consisted of getting alley-oops at the end of halves.
Yeah.
So, you know, I'm not sure.
He didn't get much PT.
He didn't get a lot of PT. You know, he looked good in there. And, you know, the other thing is that you can imagine that when you're playing with LeBron and Kobe and these guys, and they were really pumping him up. I mean, one of my favorite parts about the Olympics was just how much those guys were pumped up for Anthony Davis, especially in stark contrast to the Dream Team documentary where you see that nobody wanted Christian Laettner around. You know, I think that was a real joy for him, and he, you know, he's coming crashing down to reality, which is he plays for a franchise that's, you know, the city's not particularly interested in, and, you know, is surrounded by mostly mediocre players other than Ryan Anderson, and, you know, supposedly their best player doesn't want to play. So it's got to be a little discouraging for him as well. No, I mean, a 19-year-old kid's not immune from getting a little down from time to time. All right. Well, Chris, you also were surfing, watching a big man, everyone's favorite South American, Thiago Splitter.
Yes.
Now, originally you wanted Kawhi Leonard. Were you disappointed to have to watch Thiago Splitter all week?
No, actually, it was kind of fun to watch him. I mean, I feel like I've managed to catch a lot of Spurs games the last couple of years. And, you know, he's really, to me, watching him play or the Spurs play in Portland, it was a lot of fun to kind of watch him compared to how he's played the last couple years. So just my observation is that he's a lot more active now, it felt to me, than he was a year ago. So there's, to me, little difference, at least in the game I watched, between him and Duncan. So by that I mean Splitter's an offensive and a defensive contributor on the team. Splitter in this game didn't get a lot of minutes with Duncan, but he was effective in the minutes he got. He hit some baskets. I think he went 4 for 8 or something like that in the game. Mm-hmm. He got 3 assists. He basically got a couple blocks. He also drew the defensive assignment against LaMarcus Aldridge and was able to get three foul calls on LaMarcus. There was
two flops on a blown call in those fouls.
The fouls were marginal, but I mean it basically LaMarcus Aldridge is a really tough defensive assignment. Probably 2 of those 3 foul calls would not have gone his way, I would suspect, in a typical game. But at the same time, you know, he got them in a game. That counts for something. The other thing is some of the foul calls showed great anticipation. He's making the fact that he's putting himself in a position where the ref has to make a really difficult decision about when to call a foul and who to call it against, I think shows that he's an effective defender at the NBA level.
Do you think he's taken a step forward in any specific aspects? I mean, I remember last year watching that team, and even though he had a lot of great stretches, it seemed like Pop got frustrated with him a lot. There was a pretty notable incident during, I believe, the OKC series when Pop put him in and then immediately pulled him the next play, screaming at him and telling him to take a seat.
In my opinion, the thing that I noticed scouting is that Thiago now has, he appears to me to be able to handle the ball a little bit better than he had last year, and that's allowed him to generate better shots. I think that, and looking at the numbers, the regular season numbers between this year and last year, there's actually very little difference. So, for example, when we see his plus-minus numbers from this year, he's at plus 1.1 points a game. Last year, he's at plus 2.2 points a game. The minutes that he's played, the rebounds that he's getting, his assist numbers, there's a lot of similarities. I was actually a little bit surprised because scouting, he seemed better this year, I thought, than last. Mm-hmm. But actually, in terms of the regular season play, things are very similar in terms of his box score numbers. My feeling is that Pop is showing more confidence in him. And, you know, whereas like during the regular season last year and this year, he's getting something like 24 minutes a game. Last year in the playoffs, after Pop lost confidence in him, you know, his minutes per game were something like 13 or so.
Right.
So basically, you know, Pop really shortened that rotation up. My feeling is that he's not going to do the same thing to Splitter this year. Right. Splitter, I believe, is kind of solidified himself as the second best big man on the Spurs in front of Boris Diaw even. And I'd expect him. Well, actually, Boris Diaw was killing it last year.
He was. He had a great run for a while.
I mean, I've talked about this before. I have theories. Like, he actually, you know, was living with, what's his face, the French guy on the team.
Other French guy on the team? Are you suggesting that Thiago is French?
No. Tony Parker. Not Thiago. I was talking about Boris Diaw.
Boris Diaw. Okay.
So Boris Diaw, right, got cut, from Charlotte and then ended up, with, Tony Parker, right? In Tony Parker's spare bedroom and, like, lost like 30 pounds in the last 2 months of the season and, like, sort of was dominant actually in the playoffs last year. I thought he was, you know, one of the most important players really that the Spurs had. Anyways,
I do feel like that's a huge case for just motivation being a big factor into NBA performance.
Oh, big time. I mean, like, Diaw is absolutely a head case. Anyways, one of the thoughts that a lot of us had was that if Diaw could somehow replicate his postseason that he had last year, during the entire season this year, this would be an extremely formidable Spurs team.
That's hard to do.
Of course, it looks like he's regressed.
Season playing as well as he did in the playoffs.
It is. Yeah, he has regressed a little bit. I mean, his plus minus numbers aren't as good. You know, from what I hear, he's gained, and what I've seen, it appears that he's gained
some
of that weight back.
Take a look at his other people, Phoenix jersey, and then look at him after that. It looks like he just ate chicken for an entire year, fried chicken. It really does.
Yeah.
Well, take a look at him in a Bobcats jersey because he is adorable at 300 pounds.
The thing is,
he's listed at 235 this year. If he was
you can't trust these numbers. I don't want to talk too much about Boris Diaw, but the thing that's interesting to me is he does not have the body of a natural fatty. This is a guy I believe must eat a lot of food.
So you're saying he's not what we call in the medical industry, he's not a natty fatty.
He's not a natty fatty. He's not like a young Charles Barkley. You know, this guy I think is actually a naturally slender guy that just happens to consume quite a lot of food and maybe not work out at all, other than what he's forced to do by the professional team that he plays for. Anyways, so sorry for the side there, but my thought though is that Thiago is actually playing pretty well. The one noticeable difference between Thiago and Duncan is that Thiago is really much more comfortable scoring close to the hoop. So he basically, his range is like 8 feet and in. And so the kind of offensive moves that he has now are basically putting the ball on the floor and dribbling basically until he gets closer to the hoop and then hoisting shots up that fall from very close range. Duncan actually at this point in time is a very comfortable jump shooter out to like 15, 16, 18 feet.
That was one thing.
So,
Chris, I want to pause here for a second because in my excitement to get into our scouting reports, I failed to ask us to introduce each other and ourselves. So for the new listeners, my name is Scott, a.k.a. The Walnut, coming to you from Bodymore Murderland.
Yeah. I'm Chris Brown, coming to you for at least the next 24 hours from Ithaca, New York. I'll be a resident of Washington,
D.C. Yeah, congratulations, sir.
2 weeks.
That's a lie. He will be a resident of the state of Maryland.
Yeah.
Close enough to D.C. I'll round it.
Round it down.
Yeah, round it down.
And
I'm Manziel B. I'm podcasting out from Brooklyn today.
And I'm just across the bridge in the city of New York. Downtown, Lower East Side, maybe a little bit of Chinatown. Big shout out.
All right. Chris, Chris, back to your scouting. There was an article this week from the always amazing Zach Lowe, Grantland's newest steal. And he was breaking down some of he called it the NBA's odd couple. But breaking down some big man pairings and their efficiency and effectiveness. The first one on the list was Thiago Splitter and Tim Duncan. He seems to think that they ought to be playing together more and are a pretty deadly combination. What do you think about that?
Yeah, I really liked that article. I thought it was fun to read. Nice kind of blend of scouting and stats. My feeling though is that's a combo that we will not see a lot of from the Spurs.
And why is that?
So the reason is that Pop doesn't play these guys together that much. So for example, Duncan starts every game and the general substitution is that Splitter comes in for Duncan. So of I think, you know, the 25 games that they've played so far this season, the guy that starts with Duncan the most, at least, is Blair. Mm-hmm. I can't remember his first name, but he basically
DeJuan
Blair. So he's number one. What starts with Duncan? The second guy is Boris Diaw. The third guy is Splitter, and you know of that combination, like those three forwards that play the kind of the primary. Get the primary amount of playing time in the front court for the Spurs. Actually, Diaw gets three times as many minutes with Duncan as Splitter does. And so the other thing is that both Duncan and Splitter really are fives. Both of those guys play the five, yeah, the majority of minutes.
Right.
another point is that the style of offense that the Spurs play is really an up-tempo type offense. Mm-hmm. And so when those guys are basically, those guys don't play heavy-duty minutes. Like, really, Duncan's minutes, he's kind of a mainstay Hall of Famer on that team. He's really only getting a little over 30 minutes a game. Mm-hmm. So the thing is they
which is still pretty remarkable for a guy of his size and age. But you're right, it's declining.
Yeah, he loves to rest them all the time. So, I mean, kind of the pattern that I'm seeing, and that I don't know if this is going to hold true in the playoffs, you know, when things slow down. But really, those guys are far more likely to get substituted in for each other than substituted together at the same time.
Well, here's a follow-up question to that then. Do you think that Pop ought to consider doing what Zach Lowe says is an effective strategy, which is to play them together? Or do you like the energy that that the Spurs have by having that kind of interchangeable pieces?
I mean, I think against certain teams, especially if there's a critical defensive possession, you know, they may be played together. But generally speaking, like over the course of a game, I think that I don't think that that's necessarily a good thing. I think that really having them Duncan in sort of the starting role, and then having Splitter substituting in as a backup, you know, maintaining a really high tempo of play, and having Blair and Boris Diaw kind of switching between those two guys and whatever lineups they're in. I think that that's actually a better style of play for this version of the Spurs team, which is a kind of a really up tempo, high pace type deep roster. So my thought is, don't slow it down. This team doesn't want to play small big ball where they're playing at a slow tempo. This team really wants to play, you know, smaller ball and at a high pace of play. So I don't see, in my view, much of an advantage for playing them together at the same time.
Okay. Well, final question. Who is Thiago Splitter's favorite soccer team?
Ah, they're the San Paulo Corinthians. Apparently, on his Twitter feed.
Why do you know this?
He actually
just won the Club World Cup.
Because he's doing his research. Let that be a lesson to the kids. Do your research.
This was actually very researchy, too, because he does not write many Twitter posts in English. So I had to use Google.
Neither does DeMarcus Cousins.
You bought him on Google and translated Twitter. Google Translate. That's pretty good, Brian.
So the Corinthians won the World Championship or something. But
Club World Cup. Mm-mm. But yeah, it's a goofy Club World Cup that nobody wants to win.
World Championship of best soccer teams in Sao Paulo.
Can you win a World Championship of something if it's just in Brazil? And then I was like, well, maybe it was maybe it's something outside of Brazil. What that is, I do not know. So,
yeah. I think one thing we can all agree on is that Thiago Splitter probably has had a lot of beautiful women in his life over the course of his career.
It's possible.
And we're jealous. We're jealous of that. As we are of all NBA players.
And most Brazilians, as it turns out.
That's true. From a current San Antonio Spur to a former San Antonio Spur, Rob, you were looking at George Hill over the last week or so. Why did you pick George Hill, and what can you tell us about him?
Performer. Well done. Must practice.
Thank you.
Like I've been saying, I have a coworker who's a big Pacers fan, so he won't stop talking about it. He started giving me a trash jacket with Pacers on it.
He sounds like an irritating
free ball
person.
Well, he played on a company team, and he doesn't stop shooting, but he shoots it well. Hmm. He talks him up, so I get interested and I watch him, and you know, the Pacers aren't a team that anybody would really normally get interested in, and that's exactly what George Hill is as a point guard. He's not very flashy. He's, you know, he's right now he's at 15 points, 5 assists, 4 rebounds a game. You know, I think his biggest fault is he just doesn't really get to the line enough. The Pacers as a team are middle of the road in terms of getting the line, but I think that's their biggest problem. They don't have a guy that they can just give the ball, you know, separate, you know, spread out the court and just, you know, have somebody go one-on-one. You know, West is always going to make his game. That guy, I got to give him credit. I always thought he sucked, but he's been very consistent. He's been the backbone of that team without Granger. But watching George Hill just made me watch Paul George the entire time. Because because, yeah, you're going to see those highlights of him dunking the ball, but this guy's got a lot of potential. I know they've been saying that for a while, but he's good. Paul George.
Has he stopped growing yet? Do we know? Is there any word on that? What? Have the doctors said?
Oh, no. He's going to grow 3 more inches in the offseason, and then he's going to make
I do believe that he's due for a 15 pounds of muscle, unexpectedly.
I gained 12 pounds of muscle every day, so I'm okay with that. That's probably what's going on. But, you know, as a point guard, George Hill's only gone on the stripe 7 times. He's only gone on the stripe 7 times twice in 24 games. You know, I think that's kind of an eye-popping stat for me. I did watch him play against Denver 2 weeks ago, and I watched him play Cleveland last week. And, unfortunately, I missed his first career triple-double against 76ers, where he dropped 15, 10, and 10. But I can tell you now, anybody that watched the game probably had no idea that he had a triple-double unless they were looking at the announcers say it. You know, he really hides under the radar. Kind of a typical Popovich-type guy, you know, somebody that you don't really notice right away. But
and is he running the point?
Yeah, I mean, for the most part.
Is that his main role in there? So I'm looking at his assist numbers, and they do seem a little low.
They're not. I don't think a really high tempo team. So I mean, one of the things, the box score numbers may not be very good just because they're just not. I mean, they playing at a high pace.
Mm-hmm. But even if you look at assist percentage, his assist percentage last year was 16.5, which was by far the highest of his career. Still strikes me as pretty low for a point guard.
So wait, was that assist or assisted?
Yeah.
Assist percentage. Okay, so that's the number of buckets that are scored while the player's on the floor that he assists.
Like Brownie said, I think a lot of that has to do with pace.
Or percentage.
Vogel runs that offense. You know, I think they like to slow it down. They are the best defensive team in the NBA in terms of field goal percentage and points allowed. They only allow 90.4 points a game. They're right ahead of Thibodeau's Bulls. And field goal percentage against is 41%, so that's pretty good. They're playing really good defense.
So one thing I'm seeing off 82 games for George Hill is that while his production is relatively modest in terms of, you know, his play versus opponent point guards, he's at plus 4.1 a game. His plus minus numbers are excellent. So he's at plus 14 a game. That makes me think that he's a very solid defender.
Yeah.
Did you see anything?
He's very good. He doesn't, both on and off the ball, but it's just like I was saying on offense, he's not a flashy guy. You know, he doesn't give up too many easy buckets. It's really hard to blow by him. Every now and then, you know, he'll drop back a little bit and somebody will get a tray. But I don't really see too many flaws in his defensive game. I noticed in the Cavs game I watched, they were down about 16. They were down 16 points in the first half. And then they literally locked Kyrie Irving and their entire team down. They scored 23 points in the entire second half. It was, I'm sure... Yeah, the Cavs scored 23 points in the whole half. It was
what game was this?
Cavs,
with
man.
Kyrie Irving in?
Yeah,
that's amazing. That is really something.
The game. They were just their entire. I'm not going to give Hill all the credit. It was a lot of their whole team. They were kind of basically dialed in on him, and they were just like, let's not let Kyrie Irving score, and that really messed with the Cavs. Mm. Yeah.
That's a good strategy, and if you can pull it off, I guess good for you.
Another just kind of interesting observation is that sort of David West, George Hill, and Paul George, these guys are all playing 70% or more of the minutes, available minutes.
Yeah.
So this team's a little bit interesting in that really, like, they have some star players. They put them on the court, just don't take them off for anything.
I did.
I was just looking. You, Rob, you mentioned the free throw attempts for George Hill. I was looking into this, and so this season he's taken 84 free throw attempts and 305 shots. So it's like 27.5% of
his
shots. Well, put it this way: 2 seasons ago, his last season in San Antonio, that ratio was basically 43% or 0.43.
Whoa. Wow!
So it's a significant decline, and it looks like it happened immediately upon coming to Indiana. So I think it's that could very well also be stylistic. You know, he's not attacking the rim nearly as much and not putting himself in a position to get to the line.
If Pop was coaching Indiana, he'd be resting him a lot more and
shooting every
a lot
three,
more.
Every three games, you get a break. I could follow his Twitter feed and translate English to English. It's pretty easy.
Although unfortunately for him, his
he's not shooting well this year.
Declined.
He's not shooting well.
He's
the kind of guy I want on my team. He does everything, though. He does it all well. If he's open corner three, he's going to hit it. If somebody leaves him, he'll hit it. But,
yeah.
And he takes a lot of them. He's taken 119 so far this season.
That's a lot.
Here's a follow-up question about George Hill. Can you tell us off the top of your head what IUPUI stands for?
Oh, wow.
That's where he went to college.
It's a layup.
Manziel seems to have it. For the steal, Manziel, please tell us.
The Indiana University of Purdue University, Indiana.
Oh, so close.
Indianapolis.
No, was Indianapolis.
You had it. You had
exactly.
It.
Exactly. It's the Indiana University at Purdue. University at Indianapolis. Or whatever. UPI.
UPI.
Any other burning thoughts about
something
George
I noticed
before
that, you know, as I do think he is a good defensive player, I think he could be a little more aggressive on the ball. He only has, on and off the ball, but mostly on the ball. He's only had more than three fouls once. And to give you an idea of a good point guard, defensive point guard, Westbrook's done that 7 times in the same sample size of 24 games.
Yeah.
So I think that's some, you know, fouls obviously aren't good.
Is Westbrook a really good defensive point guard, though?
I think he is, although that's maybe that's
he's
an interesting question for another week, whether the numbers bear that out. I think Westbrook's an excellent defensive point guard who sometimes loses focus and sometimes gets out of position, but in general is a foreboding presence for opposing point guards, I think.
I think it's definitely intimidating. But George Hill, really quick, I just want to point out, he looks like he's only shooting 33%, so 10 for 30 this year on corner threes. This is a minor dropback of Vorp.com, and it's very difficult to find out what league average is on a corner three. So
it's higher than that.
Yeah, it must be. But 33% is a passable number for a
three-point
shooter.
Well, we noticed what we did
in general.
And I think he had to carry the shooting load a little bit more when Granger was out. I mean, the team was just struggling to score when Granger was gone.
This isn't a team that's blessed with a lot of offensive talent. So I mean, that may be a very good number actually in the context of the Pacers this year.
When does Hibbert come back?
Hibbert's playing.
I wasn't even aware Hibbert was out.
Oh,
he's playing.
Granger's coming back in February, but the fact that they're one game out of a division that is Milwaukee and Chicago at top of the conference, they're sitting pretty. They can hang with them. I think they'll run away with the division, be able to have home court advantage for the first round.
Yeah, it's funny. At the beginning of the season, we all talked about how the West was more wide open, and it looks less and less like that. And the East looks more and more wide open, aside from that top spot.
The Wizards beat Miami, so anybody can make the playoffs.
And they almost beat Atlanta tonight. They took Atlanta to overtime tonight. As we're recording this on Tuesday, December 18th, and you're listening to it on the day that you're listening to it.
The end of the world
is coming. Ever?
I'll be in the air when the end of the world comes. I want to be one of those planes that, you know, flies into a giant crevasse in the Antarctic or something. I saw 2012. I know what's up. I just hope John Cusack's there. Do you think that the Indiana made the right choice in putting their chips in Hill's basket? Is that an expression? No, it's not an expression. Do you think they made the right call in jettisoning Collison and
jettisoning Collison, I think that's hurt them more. I think, that Collison's obviously playing well and DJ Augustine is not as good as they thought he would be.
Can you guys refresh me or remind me of that deal that made Collison go away? Was it they have enough money to pay everyone, or what happened there?
They were looking for more. I think they thought that he wasn't their point guard anymore, and so they traded him And Mahimi, they got Jan Mahimi back, and there's somebody else involved.
Okay.
Yeah. Oh yeah, Augustine.
Mahimi has not been what they thought he would be.
And then the Collison started the season on fire, and then was subsequently benched in favor of the 114-year-old Derek Fisher.
Mm, okay. Poor Collison. Yeah, it didn't work out for anyone, I guess.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I still think George, he's an interesting
George Hill's
player.
On a pretty nice contract.
George Hill, yeah, what is it? Is it $40 million, 4 years?
40 and like five. It's 8 a year. It is no balloon. There's nothing weird about it. Just straight $8 million a year.
How old is he again?
Young. He's real young.
Was it 24? 26.
Yeah, he's extremely young.
Yeah, that's a great contract.
2 years younger than Tony Parker.
Yeah. Age 31.
That's a killer deal.
Isn't Tony Parker 28, 29?
Parker's, I think, 30.
No, he's 30.
30.
He might even be 31 by now.
I think God, he's 30. Who'd you look at?
No, he's 30.
Well, I was looking at DeMarcus Cousins, who shares a birthday with some of the all-time great luminaries and athletes, Alfred Hitchcock, Ben Hogan, Jay Buhner. Yeah, they're each geniuses in their own way, and they were each born on, of course, the most auspicious birthday, August 13th. He was born August 13th, 1990, while I was celebrating my 15th birthday, probably by myself, at my house.
I wish you had birthdays, Scott.
So I have an attachment to him. I also have an attachment to him as, you know, he's somewhat of a head case when he's on the floor, and I like to think of myself as at least a solid head case. So I've been watching him this week, and I regret the decision, not because of him, but because the Kings are a very unwatchable team. Last night being the nadir of the season for me when I sat through an entire Kings-Suns game.
But they got some of our guys that we like too, right?
They have some players that are enjoyable. They just don't appear to have an offensive philosophy. So,
by the way, did you really watch all three games this last week?
I did not watch all the Thunder games. Okay. So I watched the first half of the Thunder game, I watched the Nuggets game, and I watched almost all the Phoenix game.
This, I think you deserve a scouting gold medal for this effort. This is impressive.
It was brutal. I watched the game so you don't have to, guys.
Yeah.
But the takeaway from DeMarcus Cousins, I think, is that he's just as talented as everyone thought he was, and he's got a lot of parts of his game that need improvement. But let me start with what he does really well. And I think the number one thing he does really well is he controls the paint in an old school way. By that I mean that, you know, he's really playing both the four and the five off the ball, basically not letting anyone spend any time or make any easy cuts across the lane. If he's guarding the center and the power forward tries to establish position in the lane or make a cut through it, he's going to step off and basically elbow the guy. He's always described as being an athletic big man, which I think is sort of accurate but misleading, because when you picture athletic big men, you picture guys who play above the rim and who are very fast. Yeah. And what DeMarcus Cousins has going for him, I think, is, you know, incredible core strength. He's just a very strong guy whose power comes from the middle of his body. He doesn't have a ton of lift. He doesn't have a ton of speed. But he's got a good read on the game defensively. And I think, I thought he did a very good job in the paint against some pretty tough matchups. So, in Oklahoma City, he's having to deal with Perkins, Ibaka, and Collison, all of whom are good in their own way and are somewhat different styles. In Denver, he had to contend with Kosta Koufos, JaVale McGee, and Kenneth Faried. And then in Phoenix, for all Phoenix's shortcomings, Gortat and Scola are a difficult matchup to play against.
Yeah.
And I thought, in general, he did a good job of establishing his position in the paint on defense. So, that's a good thing for him. One thing that he's atrocious at, I guess there's two things I would say that he's really bad at, but both of which I think he can learn. First is his transition defense is just awful, as is most of the Kings' transition defense. Zach Lowe also mentioned that in his article today, which I was happy to see. Mm-hmm. They just don't get back, and he in particular is not in a rush to get back and reestablish position in transition. And the other thing is his pick and roll offense is pretty atrocious. I think part of that probably has to do with playing with Tyreek Evans for several years. Tyreek Evans, who, as far as I can tell, has never run a pick and roll in his life. Sometimes he makes moves as if there's a pick and roll, but mostly he just is holding on to the ball. So, you know, Cousins has a tendency to set pretty lazy picks. He sets picks that, were he a better player or on a better team, would probably get called for fouls. You know, he sticks his butt out. He kind of drifts through guys. He doesn't have real crisp decision-making when it comes to the pick and roll. But he's also a very young kid, and personally, I think that those are all things that are very fixable. So I'm looking forward to his development. You know, one thing when you look at his numbers, if you look at 82games.com and look at his breakdown, what you see is that he takes a lot of mid-range jumpers and misses a lot of mid-range jumpers.
It's brutal there.
Yeah. But here's what I think about that. And, you know, again, this might be me being overly optimistic because he's a blood brother in birth, and he got the same birthday. His shot doesn't look bad from that range.
He's got really good ball skills.
Yeah. He's got a nice handle. And, you know, he's got a pretty decent stroke. He actually has a pretty decent release point on his jumper. But, you know, what you see is that the reason he's getting a lot of jumpers and taking a lot of jumpers is because the other teams desperately want DeMarcus Cousins to be shooting jumpers. That is a great possession for the defense because he's their number one offensive rebounder. So that takes him out of the offensive rebounding equation. And, you know, he's not a particularly great mid-range shooter. Again, though, I think that's something that will develop. The shot doesn't look broken or ugly to me. He doesn't have a lot of lift. But he doesn't need a ton of lift with his size and release point making jumpers.
So Scott, you know, referencing the 82games.com website again, I noticed that his plus minus this year is a little bit lower than it was last year. Is this just statistical noise, or do you see sort of a difference in the play this year compared to last, where he's just not producing at the same level?
Well, I think it's, you know, you see his rebounding rate is way down. He's never been a great defensive rebounder, but he gets them. You know, he actually led the league in total rebounds last season. And I see him being a little bit less aggressive on that front this season. Some of that I think is he's trying to develop on other aspects of his game, but I think his plus minus numbers will improve as his rebounding rate improves a little bit. But I do think there's some statistical noise, and you know, the noise is generated by the fact that the Kings are a chaotic organization. It's really, you know, they fired Paul Westphal, which I was totally fine with. They've got Keith Smart in there now. I don't think Keith Smart's doing a lot that's all that different.
Sure.
But they run bizarre offensive sets. A lot of times a point guard will bring it up the floor and then drift over to the corner where DeMarcus will basically start the possession at the top of the key all by himself. And, so basically you've got, you know, a defender of his sagging off of him into the lane, you know, double teaming, taking up passing lanes. It's just not a very good way to start an offense. And so I do think that some of that is noise. But I also think this, I don't, you know, there's always the debate, is player X or player Y a star? Yeah. I don't know if that's necessarily a meaningful debate, but I do think that DeMarcus Cousins is a really excellent fundamental big man in a lot of ways. Mm-hmm. Despite some physical shortcomings, he's got a very, you know, weak jump. He gets rim checked, he gets blocked. But in general, he's still a very athletic player and has tremendous ball skills.
Yeah. So, Scott, how would you compare him to Zach Randolph kind of developmentally?
It's a little bit difficult for me to say because I did not watch a lot of early Zach Randolph. I don't think he's as strong as Zach Randolph. But, you know, he punishes opposing centers and power forwards. He doesn't always, you know, play above the rim with them, and that's a shortcoming. But, you know, he is a guy that will make it very hard for you to get position if you're trying to. And in some cases will, you know, essentially chase guys off of their spots. Even really big, powerful guys like, you know, Marcin Gortat last night. Gortat is a beast. And, you know, I think he's one of the more underrated players in the NBA. And yeah. It wouldn't be accurate to say that Cousins controlled him, but you could see that Cousins was making life a lot more difficult for Gortat than he usually would. So yeah. In that sense, I see that he's like Randolph. His offensive game just isn't very polished. A lot of his most successful shots are just rebounding and putbacks. So in that sense, you know, he's again a prototypical big man. But until he gets on a team that has competent shooters and competent ball distributors, those skills don't translate to very much. Mm. So I don't think he can help his team a ton when the rest of the team is in dysfunction.
So another question, I guess, kind of. You know, when I watched him play in college, I thought that the sky was the limit for him in terms of just, you know, his development as like the future of, kind of post player in the NBA. Mm-hmm. And I think this view is shared by a lot of guys within the NBA as well. I remember watching the, freshman sophomore game at mm-hmm. the NBA All-Star game last year, and guys like, Shaq and Barkley, you know, would watch that game, and at halftime and at the end of the game would comment on how well DeMarcus played and yet how much more they expected of him. So they basically were of the opinion that he needed to be producing double-double every game. And right. So I guess my question is, do you see that this guy should be a double-double machine moving forward in the NBA? Is he a superstar, or is he kind of merely a very good, you know, big man with a certain amount of potential?
Well, first of all, I think he is a double-double guy right now. You know, his per 36 minutes average is 19.6 points and 11.6 rebounds. He's averaging 16 points and 9 rebounds a game, close to 10 rebounds a game. So I do think he's there, but I did think that one of the things that is telling about that anecdote is the fact that Shaq and Barkley played in a different era, and there was less above the rim. Those Barkley and Shaq were a lot more above the rim players than DeMarcus is, but there were a lot of great, big men that didn't necessarily elevate a lot. And I think that that's the case with DeMarcus Cousins. I think he makes up for that with, you know, again, great senses on rebounding, just sort of a great touch, really. Excellent ball handling skills and ball control skills when he comes down with the rebound. Just awesome tipping in. But, you know, I don't think the sky's the limit. I think the rim is the limit for him. You know, he's never going to be this new breed of above-the-rim players. And so that's why I think he needs to be on a team that has guys that are good shooters and one or more kind of guys that can create for themselves. On that team, you know, you've got Isaiah Thomas can create for himself pretty well. Occasionally, Jimmer can create for himself pretty well. Yeah, you know, he's had a few really good games. He's sort of, I think, catching up to where people expected him to be when they drafted him, speaking of Jimmer.
No way, but he still sucks at defense.
Well, then, and that's what people were expecting, so he's living up to expectations. But, you know, with the main thing with Cousins, I think that people need to just remember is that he's still a very young player, and he's been surrounded by young players in a dysfunctional organization that was constantly under threat of moving and generally in disarray. Mm-hmm. A place that used to be one of the best arenas in the league and is now the sleep train arena, which says
that's
it
good
all.
For us. So,
I guess the question people.
Yeah, well, you know, it is. He may be a Sonic soon, and I think that he's a good foundational player. And one other thing about the Kings before we move on that is interesting is that Jason Thompson is essentially playing in the front court with DeMarcus most of the time. He's a really good player. He's just a very solid fundamental player. He's actually, I think, a little bit more springy than Cousins, and so that causes a little bit of problems for the defense. Mm-hmm. So I think that those two together are the foundation for that team moving forward if I'm making the plans. All the other pieces are totally expendable, except maybe Jimmer from a marketing standpoint. I don't think there's anyone else in that team that I would say is not replaceable.
So wait, Scott, I you broke up a little bit. Did you say that you'd keep Jimmer around for marketing purposes?
Yeah, I guarantee you Jimmer Fredette sells more merchandise than any Sacramento Kings since Chris Webber. I mean, I can look it up, but yeah, people love Jimmer.
that people can't love last Zimmer much longer, right?
I don't know. It's a nationwide thing. It's not like the city of Sacramento. You know, people go on Amazon. There's still a ton of Jimmer Fredette merchandise for sale. I just think, you know, he's a guy that people love and can be a draw. And frankly, you know, he's a fun player coming off the bench. You know, he is a very fundamentally sound player.
They are stuck with him for the 2.5 years.
After watching a lot of Kings, do you think Jimmer can turn into a JJ Redick type player?
No. I don't, but I didn't think J.J. Redick was going to turn into a J.J. Redick type player.
So you're
I think the difference is Jimmer's... Jimmer, to me, is just smaller and doughier. He's less athletic in general. And, you know, it's possible. You see some of his moves out there, and you know, he's always going to be able to score one-on-one with a lot of guards in the league. Whether or not he can play defense as Redick has learned to do and sort of accept a role on the team, who knows? It's certainly possible. But, the most important takeaway, kids, as you're listening to this is don't watch Kings games.
Watch it.
You know what? I have to admit, I'm, as a Seattle Supersonics fan, I'm loving this. I'm like, lose, Kings lose. I want another high draft pick and I want this team to move to Seattle.
Agreed.
Like, you know, if they get another top three, top four pick, move to Seattle, oh man, this is going to be an awesome team to watch as they mature.
Couldn't agree more. All right, guys. Well, that was some excellent scouting. Hopefully that was interesting to the folks listening. Moving on here, we got some sad news for those of us who love to read about basketball this week. John Hollinger, the godfather of the PER statistic and the daily writer of the per diem column on ESPN, it was announced that he was taking a job as vice president with the Grizzlies this week. Obviously, we're excited for him and bummed for ourselves, as I just heard someone yawn. I just heard someone yawn. Yawn alert. Yawn alert. We wanted to talk about Hollinger a little in a segment that we call Dear John, because he's so dear to everyone that loves reading about basketball. And the logical place to start is with his claim to fame, the player efficiency rating, or PER. Menzel, can you explain in what's that?
Yeah, so per the stat that you probably heard us throw around a few times, but it's a little bit controversial. We'll get into that in a second. But just to break down Scott and Chris and Rob for you too, what goes into PER. So the basic idea is that there are positive events that happen on the court, such as hitting a shot, hitting a free throw, getting a steal, and so forth, and there are negative events, turning the ball over, committing a foul, missing a shot. And effectively, well, what PER is you just add up those good events, you subtract the bad events, you adjust for team pace and the kind of the league context of the value of a possession, and then you come up with a number, and that number is anywhere between basically 0 and 35.
And what does that number represent? In other words, to say that someone has a high PER, what does it mean?
I guess what you call production. It's rated per minute on a per minute basis. How much stuff are you producing that's good? There are ways that PER can kind of be gamed to show a higher rating when they're not necessarily contributing more. And there are some issues with guys who have low minutes. But it's in between a counting, raw counting stat and a rate stat.
Okay. And it's called the player efficiency rating. Can you explain to us, why that concept is in the name of the stat and how it's reflected in the stat?
So it's a little bit hard to get into the math of it, but, the way it works is by assigning certain values to events based more or less on either the number of points they produce or the number of possessions they gain or lose your team. For example, the value of a missed shot, that's a negative thing, that's scaled based on the amount of points you might expect the other team to score on that possession. Or the same thing goes for offensive rebounds, defensive rebounds, things like that. They're scaled to kind of what they're worth. So there is what it does reward guys for is in relationship to league average, doing things that are basically more efficient. If the way the game is played, that hitting a 3-point shot or a 2-point shot is super duper duper efficient, then it'll reward guys who do that more.
And when we're talking about efficiency, correct me if I'm wrong, but it seems to me that one of the sort of movements right now in hoops analytics and in general over the last decade has been a shift from, you know, games, game averages or per minute averages to looking at possessions. You mentioned possessions a lot during, your segment. So is it maybe a fair nutshell to say that the PER mentions or essentially tries to evaluate how efficiently players use the possessions that they have?
In a way, yes. Although, just to get back to what I was saying, the value of a made shot is not equal to the negative value of a missed shot.
Sure.
You know, so there are some discrepancies and some places there to kind of run up the score.
So, actually, this is a silly question, but that I see that as being one of the problems with a statistic. So, I mean, a missed shot is a bad thing. It should be equal to, if it results in a change in possession, it should be equal to a made shot. So, for example, you know, I read about, I'm kind of jumping into maybe one criticism of Per, but Dave Barry, for example, for the author of Wages of Wins, you know, does this analysis where he says, you know, 3-point field goal is worth 2.65 points using in per. A missed field goal costs the team 0.72 points. You know, 2-point field goal that's made is 1.65 points. Anyways, when you start breaking these numbers down, it turns out that a player gets a positive contribution when they hit only 30% of their 2-pointers, and a positive contribution if they hit above 21% of the 3-pointers. Any competent NBA player is going to hit above those numbers. And so,
okay. So the formula does kind of correct for that in a lot of ways.
I mean, the thing that I'm saying, that these thresholds that are set in PER basically are set so that, you know, any player in the league, as long as they're jacking shots up, is going to have a bigger per number the more shots they take.
Well, but per doesn't start at zero, right? I mean, the concept of per is that the league average will be 15.
Yeah.
And so Hollinger's trying to work out from that. And so I think the defense of valuing missed shots with a lower integer than made shots is that most shots are missed. And so, it seems to me that you're sort of normalizing it against league averages. Most shots that are, you know, made in the NBA are missed. And so a missed shot, arguably should not be the same value, as a made shot. And, you know, I think that's one defense of it. But, you know, Chris,
because of that that adjustment to league average, it doesn't really work to say that it rewards you. You get more points because you're still adjusting to what everyone else is doing as well. So if you go out there and start jacking up a bunch of shots, you know, you are going to gain points, but you're changing the baseline for what league average is as well. So you may not come out ahead.
Yeah, Chris,
I understand that more shots are missed than hit, you know, over the course of the year, but this threshold to me is set too low. I do not like the fact that inefficiency is not punished more heavily in this formula. And to me, I feel like, you know, while I see the value for this formula and have a lot of respect for it for various reasons, this is, to me, a problem.
Well, here's an interesting follow-up that maybe we should have started with, which is, What use is this statistic? Putting aside its reliability as a measure of player efficiency on offense, if you're a GM or you're Hollinger going to the Grizzlies and the Grizzlies are interviewing Hollinger and they're asking him, all right, you know, PER is fun. People like talking about it. People like reading about it. How does knowledge of PER help you construct a better basketball team?
Well,
I'm looking at the 2011-2012 regular season PER. And if you look at the top ranked players, you have LeBron James, Chris Paul, Dwayne Wade, Kevin Durant, Kevin Love, Dwight Howard. Can you imagine five of those six? That'd be what? Howard, Durant, Wade, James, and Chris Paul. Can you imagine a better five-person roster? Yeah.
No, I mean, that's a pretty unimpeachable top five.
You know, and the best part about Hollinger is he admits that there are flaws, and he knows that there are things in terms of defense and in terms of, you know, not calculating all the shots. But when you look at it for an entire year, you know, five of the top six right there are the best, you know, it's the best starting five in basketball. So I think that's, you know, there is some science behind it.
I think it's
very accurate in terms of, as a GM, any GM would look at that and see, oh, okay, well, Hollinger clearly, his numbers are in defense of how I would say 90% of GMs would draft the best possible team.
Sure, and I think that when you're talking about, one of the things that Hollinger does is that he goes back over his list and sees, are there guys on here that shouldn't be, that, you know, our eyes tell us are not very good players, and he tries to adjust the formula for that. But I guess I'm also wondering, of course those guys are the top players, and a statistic that attempts to measure overall offensive efficiency, it's only really, I think, a credible stat if those guys are at the top. But is it useful to have a single kind of catch-all stat when you're comparing players? In other words, if I'm having an argument with Chris at Schultz's about whether or not Larry Bird or Magic Johnson was better, does PER really answer that question? Chris, what do you think?
I mean, I think, you know, I like, I'm not a huge fan of PER, but I do have a respect for the fact that it's a one simple number that's easy to comprehend. It basically kind of distills a whole lot of different elements that are in a box score to one thing. And so if you're having an argument about who's the best player or who's going to be who's an MVP player, who should make an all-star team, this is the kind of number along with, you know, say the winning record of the team or the playoff record of the team that player is on. These are really simple concepts that lend themselves towards discussion of value or easy comparison of value of different players. You know, I have a little bit of beef with the fact, and, you know, I also respect that sort of his list, according to Per, you know, reflects basically the list of what everybody intuitively considers to be the best players in the NBA. I do have a little bit of a problem that he kind of cooks his formula to reflect, you know, what we think are the best players. In my view, you know, you shouldn't have to twist the formula or bend a formula to basically make its output conform to what we believe should happen before we put numbers into it. But I mean, that's
so.
Well, he's admitted that he cooks it. I mean, he's admitted that as he developed it, you know, someone can correct me if I'm wrong, but you know, that he was looking for essentially a way to separate players out, and to the extent that he came out with formulas where he was seeing names that he didn't think belonged there, he would try to go back and look at if he was maybe overvaluing certain things. You know, the interesting thing about PER from a historical perspective is that it's probably not a surprise to anyone that the historical, the all-time highest PER is a man named Michael Jordan.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know how he cooks it, but my guess is that, you know, based on our understanding of, like, actually, like, shooting efficiency and plus minus and things like that, is that Per, amongst a lot of the more, you know, advanced statistical sort of analysis techniques, rewards scoring. It rewards volume scoring, not necessarily efficiency. So my thought is, you know, if you're going to draw a list up, you know, say no one has done any advanced statistical analysis yet, you're going to look at a list of guys that score a lot, and then you're going to attempt to come up with an advanced statistical measurement that replicates that to some extent. Mm-hmm. So this is a list that's going to have, you know, carry weight with volume scores.
Well, it's interesting that, you know, I was just looking at the numbers for a player who is historically regarded as one of the least efficient players, and that's Allen Iverson.
Yeah.
And, you know, his PER is not terrible, for most of his career appears to have hovered around 20. Now, to put that in perspective, right now, you know, Jimmer Fredette is at 20.9. Kemba Walker is at 19.66. So that would seem to indicate that perhaps Allen Iverson, that, you know, it, people are right to call him inefficient.
You know, I used to...
But again, that seems more about barroom arguments than anything else.
So I actually want to talk about AI for a second when it comes to efficiency. I used
the
to
Steven
really
Spielberg
hate...
movie or the basketball player?
I used to really hate Iverson. I'd see his line of like 25 to 35 shots a night and his field goal percentage, which was very pedestrian. And I thought, God, this guy must be horrible. One of the ways in which my thinking has changed, and I don't think this has really been discussed, is how volume and usage relate to success. You know, so we look at current high volume scorers like Kobe right now is the prime example. AI is the perfect example before. Is like, what is the alternative to him taking those 35 shots?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And you know, what can you expect if you ask Jimmer Fredette to take 30 shots in the game? You know, what types of lines are you looking at? Are they going to be as good or as efficient as these high volume, low efficiency scorers? So you say, I mean, I just want to say, like, you take, let's take a generic kind of high volume scorer who's not inefficient, like Deron Williams or Deron Williams. Thanks, Scott. You know, if you up his usage to superhuman Monte Ellis levels,
does that type of guy maintain his
efficiency, or does
much
it
much smaller gap than upping Jimmer Fredette to Deron Williams? So,
It is, and that's something that could happen. You might want to say maybe.
Yeah, but I think
feed Williams the ball more often.
Well, you know, I'm looking over.
The style of play that he's capable of doing. You know what I mean? He's a shooter. He is a pure shooter, and you know, he doesn't have an all around game like Deron Williams that he can last as a, you know, 30 shots a game type person. And obviously, the more you shoot, the more shots he takes, the worse they're going to be as they go. He's pretty much got one type of shot.
Yeah, it's so that, I mean, that's dope. Why I kind of want to shift the argument to someone that, you know, could see a drastic uptick in their usage.
Who do you guys think is number two in PER, since we all know who's number one in PER?
So
Durant.
I would actually say Durant.
D-Wade.
Durant.
D-Wade is nowhere near the top. Kevin Durant's number two.
Yeah.
I actually think Chris Bosh has a higher PER than Dwayne Wade. And just on your usage issue, before, I know we're running a little long on this segment, but one of the interesting things that jumped out at me on this list of current PER in the 2012-13 season is that Ivan Johnson has a, not a significantly higher, but Ivan Johnson has the 45th highest PER, and Al Horford has the 48th highest PER.
Yeah, Ivan Johnson is just a better player.
Stop that! He's terrible! Ivan the terrible!
Well, one thing is, they have roughly the same usage rates, but obviously Ivan Johnson plays a much fewer minutes. So, this is also, I think there can be distortion here based on, you know, who Ivan Johnson is playing against and what units he's playing with.
Yeah, this is actually, there's a weird thing about PER in that there is a team effect. I look at the formula and I can't quite figure out because on teams that don't go to the free throw line and have a low overall assist percentage, so the number of their field goals that are assisted, those guys will in general see an uptick in PER.
Here's a stupid question, but like, is the total rate of scoring controlled in PER? So if a team is scoring 200 points a game and their opponent's scoring 199 and another team is scoring 100 points a game, their opponent's scoring 99. Is that first team going to have a higher PER overall because of their greater scoring, their greater number of assists, greater rebounds, things like that?
The pace effects.
Yeah. Okay. All right.
So there, yeah. The factors external to the counting stats are basically the league field goal percentage and the number of points per possession throughout the league, so averaged through all the other 29 teams, as well as the team's own internal assist percentage.
Yeah.
So those are kind of the two factors that go into things. And the defensive rebounding rate as well gets thrown in there.
Now, the one other thing that, you know, PER not necessarily is criticized for, but certainly a limit in terms of its usage, is that it does not take, as far as I can tell, any defensive contributions into consideration.
It takes in blocks, steals, and defensive rebounds.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But
those poorly, know. I mean, your point is well taken, though. Those don't necessarily indicate the effectiveness of a player on defense. It actually, in some
Not
cases, may be the opposite. So a player that gets more steals may gamble more, may not be as sound on defense.
Anyway. Yeah, I think we were talking about that a couple weeks ago when you did the Tony Parker, who's Dragic, player A, player
right.
B comparison.
Right. Well, it's interesting. You know, I think one of the things that we'll discover as we discuss more and more of these statistics is that even though they're fun to talk about and fun to discuss, I'm always a little skeptical about how useful they are when making basketball decisions. So it'll be fun to see how Hollinger influences that team and whether or not he can help.
Yeah.
You know, I don't know if you guys have ever used the trade machine on ESPN. Have you guys used that?
Yeah, I did it today.
It is. It's a lot of fun. And you know, but one of the things about the trade machine that bugs me a little bit is that it essentially uses PER to calculate wins added to players. And I think that's the kind of thing where you take a single statistic and you take it too far because it's just not that simple. You know, as Kurt Goldsberry explained in that Grantland article, his debut Grantland article a couple weeks ago, you know, he described basketball as an ecosystem. And I think that's right, where plugging in a guy's PER from one team doesn't always transfer. Now, with a guy like LeBron or Durant, it probably does. But with a lot of guys that are in the middle of the pack, I'm not sure how much it tells you.
Yeah.
But it's a lot of fun to read about. And
in a weird way, like stratomatic basketball is almost better because you're forced to consider the various categories in which guys contribute. You know, do we need rebounds? Do we need assists? Blah, blah, blah.
We wish Hall
one block.
What's that?
Well, I just hope good luck to Hollinger in his position. I think it'd be fun to see what he does. You know, now that he's in a kind of a position of power with a team.
Yeah, what do we expect him to do? Is he gonna have his own super secret player evaluation methodology? Or
yes, that's what I assume he will have. You know, I think he is smart enough to realize that, especially that since PER is essentially open source, I mean, the formula is on Wikipedia, that he's going to have to develop other tools, and to actually add value to the organization. But the other thing about Hollinger that I think, you know, my good friend Damon pointed this out to me before I started reading him, is that Hollinger is just an excellent writer, a great communicator, and I think somebody that can really have a good impact on an organization. Aside from his obviously sharp analytical skills, he's not just a number cruncher. He really is a sort of holistic basketball man, and that's one of the reasons why I'm going to miss him. Tom Haberstroh's taken over the Per Diem column for those of us with Insider, and so far I think he's been doing a great job. I have every reason to believe that he's going to be fantastic. But Hollinger, we're going to miss you.
Before we finish out here. The Sacramento Supersonics traded
Absolutely.
Marcus Jordan, Tyreke Evans, Jason Thompson, Jimmy Fredette for LeBron James. It was
perfect. I love it.
I like that. Yeah.
How many wins does that add?
That's a winner.
I really like Jason Thompson, boy. But Tyreke Evans needs a change.
It will help
scenery.
Sacramento
These
and
are not
Miami.
Going well for him.
Let me give you guys another trade machine real quick. Rob, I think you like this one. Kevin Love for Tristan
Ooh,
Thompson and
I
Anderson
think,
Bergeron.
I think Thompson and Bergeron.
And a pick.
I like that one.
I still don't know what to make of Kevin Love. You know, I... baby, don't hurt me. All right. Well, that's a discussion for another day. A great talk, guys. Anything else that you guys want to bring up about PER before we move into our assignments for next week?
No, I think we're good. All right. I am, at least.
Guys, I decided to punish myself again this week. I forced myself to watch the Kings, and this week I'm going to force myself to watch one of the other worst offenses in the league, the Philadelphia 76ers. Maybe Bynum will come back and I'll be rewarded, but I'm going to be scouting Evan Turner. He's a guy that I've been hearing a lot of good things about this season. I was pretty down on him last season and really thought that he wasn't contributing very much to that 76ers team, despite putting up some pretty decent numbers sometimes. So I want to take a look at him and watch him this week and see what he's doing and see what he's up to. So next week when we get back, or I guess it'll be a little after Christmas, I'll be ready to tell you about the wonder that is Evan Turner. Chris, who are you going to be watching this week?
So I'm going to read and do some research on Deron Williams. So he's Brooklyn Nets' new $100 million man, whose kind of new contract appears to have coincided with a somewhat diminished level of play on his part. So I'm going to try and figure out if this is true or not true, and if so, what's the reason.
Chris, the number one question we expect you to answer next week is, now that we're seeing Deron Williams bulk up, is he a natty fatty?
I can answer that question already.
We know he's a fatty, but is he a natty fatty?
He's a natty fatty. This guy, we'll see. I don't want to bias. I need to do the research first, right. But I have a feeling that sort of his newfound girth is is slowing him down a bit on the court. Anyway.
Big shot. Are reluctant to pick, I think, because you think it's against your religion. You said you might want to throw out a team and ask us to pick a player for you.
Scott, so, you are the chosen one.
Do you have a sense of what team you want to look at?
3 seconds to name a player. Ready? Chicago Bulls.
All right. Three. Yes, sir.
One. All right. Taj Mahal.
Taj Gibson.
The choice.
Yeah, you know, I think... He's been, it looks to me like he's fallen off considerably this year. And, with Derrick Rose coming back, I think they really need Taj Gibson's contribution. So, you know, let us know how he's doing. Let us know if you think, there's something fundamentally wrong or if he's maybe just being asked to do too much. So, I'll be interested. You know, last night the Bulls lost a brain breaker to the Grizzlies. I think the final score was 11-8. Is a brutal game, so good luck watching the Bulls for
us. 3 field goals and a safety?
Yeah. Boy, you know, I think Rob and I are watching two of the least exciting offenses in recent basketball memory.
Yeah, I couldn't
Sixers
find any player on the Bulls.
And these Bulls without Derrick Rose.
Yeah.
Manziel?
Could be one of those Simmons victims of guys who get so underrated they become overrated.
I can see that.
Manziel, who are you going to watch this week?
I'm going to continue my big man series. Someone who may or may not be a natty fan is Nikola Pekovic.
Natty. That guy's a natty mountain. Commander. He's a beast. There's not an ounce of fat on him.
I don't know. You know, I'm
rather lean.
I don't know if he is for real as a basketball player.
You know what's extremely for real is his tattoo. Have you guys seen the tattoo he has? Of like the warrior
the
knight
crusader,
with a sword.
Basically?
There's like a pile of skulls at his feet.
It's funny. I just found out recently those are Croatian skulls.
Of course they are. He's Montenegrin. What other kinds of skulls are there? A lot of people don't know that Montenegro had a skull-based economy from 1987 to 1988. So that might have been when he got his tattoo as a child. But, you know, Peck's a beast. You're going to love watching him. And now that Rubio's back, you've definitely got the most fun assignment of any of us. Although I believe they choked away tonight's game as well. Let me look. They were not playing particularly well, and they got beat in the second half by Orlando last night. So we'll see what happens.
You know, that's a team that really needs Brandon Roy to come back and write the ship.
The Timberwolves?
They'll be back next week.
Yeah. They need something. All right. Well, this has been a great one, guys. Thanks a lot. We are going to be off on Christmas evening next week, but we will get a show out hopefully later in the week. Maybe some of us will even get some new recording equipment for Christmas. We'll see.
All right. Good night, guys.
Well, if you want to go now, you can, but you'll be missing out on everyone's favorite part of the show, which is Rob sings us out.
Oh,
Rob,
yes.
I believe that you've been multitasking this whole time a song about the show. Can you sing us out? And everybody say goodnight here before we listen to Rob's song. Chris, you've already said goodbye, but I'll say goodbye on behalf of myself. I'll see you next week, everybody.
A goodbye. Long, long time ago, goodbye. I can still remember.
Go ahead, Rob, sing us out.
The first 3-point I shot made me smile. Anthony Davis knew if he had his chance, he'd lead Kentucky to the big dance. But the NBA is tougher by a mile. 'Cause they bring boys like Tiago Splitter, dudes like Boogie who are big hitters. Bad news for Boogs and the Kings. Soon Seattle will take over their team. And if I had to say one more thing, I hope that Memphis can get the ring. John Hollinger, you stud, are a king. So bye-bye, Mr. Stats Guru Guy. I will miss you, I will kiss you just for telling me why. Those good old stats were like a fat piece of pie. You even makes a little part of me die. You even makes a little part of me die.
Makes a little part of us die.
That was awesome, Rob. We gotta lead.
Make us all famous.
We gotta lead the show off with this. This was incredible.
Good night.
All right. Good night, everybody.
Good night.
Please.
Yeah.